Midnight in the lab, bright screens like tides, long red letters drift where the old world hides.
Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So I want you to imagine opening a massive history book that chronicles the entire story of life on Earth.
Oh, I love a good history book analogy.
Right. So you're flipping through the chapters, following this grand timeline of our planet. You see the early chaotic magma oceans, you know, the first primitive single-cell bacteria. And then suddenly you just hit a blank section.
Completely blank pages.
Exactly. Not just a missing page or two, but a massive, agonizing 600 million year gap of almost nothing.
It is a profoundly frustrating gap for biologists.
Yeah. And this gap sits right in the middle of a geological era we call the Mesoproterozoic, which stretches roughly from 1.6 to 1.0 billion years ago. On one side of the gap, we have these faint traces of the earliest complex cell.
Right, the early pioneers.
And on the other side, an explosion of recognizable, incredibly diverse life. But right in the middle, it's just silent.
They're all silent.
The fossil record goes so incredibly quiet that scientists actually dubbed this era the boring billion. I mean, it's like staring at those blank pages and wondering, like, was everything on the planet just paused?
Like somebody hit the pause button on evolution.
Exactly. Did evolution take a 600 million year nap? Or, and this is the crazy part, was a massive, invisible biological war secretly raging the entire time, just completely hidden from our view?
That is the ultimate question, really. Because if we are misunderstanding what actually happened during those 600 million years, we are fundamentally misunderstanding the origin story of complex life itself.
Which brings us to the absolute core of today's deep dive. We're looking at how changing our view of this so-called boring era could completely rewrite the ancestry of every single complex organism on Earth.
Including us.
Including you, the listener. The cells in your body right now, the plants outside your window, all of it traces back to this dark age. But how do you even begin to investigate a time period that seemingly left zero trace of itself?
Well, today we celebrate the work of Miguel M. Sandin, Phoebe A. Cohen, Helene Morlon, and Fabian Berkey, affiliated with institutions including Uppsala University, the Institut de Biologie Evolutiva, Williams College, and the Institut de Biologie de l'École Normale Supérieure, who have advanced our understanding of early eukaryotic evolution in their 2026 PNAS publication.
And to really appreciate the massive breakthrough these researchers achieved, we first have to wrap our heads around the huge problem they were trying to solve in the first place.
Oh, definitely. It was a monumental roadblock.
And that roadblock is tracking down Alaceae, the last eukaryotic common ancestor.
Right. So Alaceae is the theoretical progenitor of all eukaryotes. And when we say eukaryotes, we're talking about a very specific, very advanced architectural upgrade in biology.
It's the VIP club of complex life, basically.
Exactly. These are organisms with complex cells that have a distinct central command center, you know, the nucleus, and specialized internal compartments or organelles.
And this VIP club includes everything from like a microscopic amoeba all the way up to towering redwood trees and blue whales, right?
Yep. And human beings. Basically, if it is alive today and it isn't bacteria or archaea, it's a eukaryote.
So you, me, and a grocery store mushroom all share this ancient eukaryotic grandmother.
We absolutely do.
But the physical fossil record tells a really frustrating story about her descendants, doesn't it?
Incredibly frustrating. I mean, when we look at the physical rocks, we do see unambiguous eukaryotes around 1750 million years ago. Paleontologists have found these ancient single-celled fossils called acritarchs.
So they were definitely there.
Right. They clearly had complex internal structures, so we know the VIP club existed back then. But here is the rub if you were looking for undisputed representatives of modern groups, what we call crown groups.
Like the direct ancestors of red or green algae.
Exactly. Those don't actually show up in the rock record until much, much later, around 1050 to 950 million years ago.
Okay, let's unpack this. If the physical rocks are virtually empty for those intervening 600 million years, aren't scientists just guessing about what happened?
I can see why it looks that way, yeah.
I mean, why should we trust anything other than a physical fossil you can actually hold in your hand?
It definitely feels counterintuitive to trust something you can't see over something you can. But paleobiologists have to calmly grapple with a harsh statistical reality known as the Spilborongus effect.
The Spilborongus effect? Break that down for us, because that sounds really counterintuitive.
Well, the concept is entirely based on probability. Because the fossil record is so incredibly incomplete, the oldest known fossil of a specific group will basically always be much younger than the group's actual origin date.
Wait, always?
Almost always, yeah.
Yeah.
Think about the crazy conditions required to create a fossil. An organism has to die in the exact right sediment, avoid getting eaten, avoid decaying.
They get compressed under the right chemistry.
Right. And then that specific rock has to survive for a billion years without getting melted down by plate tectonics or erosion.
So you essentially need an absolute lottery ticket of geological luck.
Exactly. And the math reflects that. If a species exists for 10 million years and contains billions of individuals, maybe only a tiny handful ever fossilize.
Wow. Okay.
So the statistical probability that the one fossil you hold in your hand happens to be the very first individual of that species to ever exist is virtually zero. You are always finding a latecomer.
Ah, I see.
Now, factor in what these early life forms actually looked like. These early protists were squishy. They were just microscopic blobs of jelly, really.
So no bones or teeth to leave behind?
Right. They completely lacked the hard structures like shells or bones or tough cellulose walls that easily fossilize.
So the absence of fossils doesn't mean an absence of life. It just means the life that was there didn't leave a physical calling card we could easily find.
Precisely.
But if their bodies were too squishy to fossilize, their physical trail is essentially dead. Yet they had to pass down instructions to their descendants. Does that mean the evidence isn't in the rocks, but in the cells of things alive today?
Yes. That is the pivotal realization driving the methodology of this research. The team realized they had to bypass the sparse rock record entirely.
They needed a time machine.
They needed a genetic time machine. So they utilized this massive, really innovative computational approach called environmental phylogenetics.
Environmental phylogenetics. Let's look at how that actually works, because it solves a massive bottleneck in biology, right? The issue of the uncultured majority.
It solves it brilliantly, yes. Historically, if you wanted to sequence the DNA of a microbe, you had to physically grow it in a lab.
Like in a little petri dish.
Right, you had to isolate it, put it on some agar, and coax it to multiply. But the problem is that the vast overwhelming majority of microbial life on Earth simply refuses to grow in a lab.
Really? They just die?
Yeah. They are deeply reliant on the complex chemical soup of their specific natural habitats. If you move them, they die.
They're the divas of the microscopic world.
They absolutely are divas. So environmental sequencing bypasses the petri dish entirely. Researchers go out into the world, say, taking a scoop of coastal mud or a liter of deep ocean water, and they just extract all the raw DNA present in that sample at once.
Just a giant smoothie of genetic data.
Exactly. A massive soup of genetic material from thousands of different uncultured organisms. For this study, the researchers zeroed in on a very specific, highly informative stretch of that DNA.
And what stretch was that?
It's the near full eukaryotic ribosomal operon, often called the 18S28S rDNA.
Okay, but why that specific stretch? I mean, if you have this massive soup of DNA, why look at just the 18S28S section?
Because it acts as the perfect deep time barcode. Every single living cellular organism needs ribosomes. They're the tiny factories that build proteins.
Right, so they're essential.
Utterly essential. Because this machinery is so critical to survival, the genetic code for it mutates at a very slow, very predictable rate. If it mutated too fast, the ribosome would break and the organism would just die.
Ah, so it's stable.
Very stable. By comparing the slight differences in this specific rDNA sequence across thousands of organisms, scientists can measure exactly how closely related they are to one another.
And this team didn't just look at a handful of samples, did they? They built a monumental data set.
They processed 75,975 non-redundant operational taxonomic units, or OTUs.
Okay, wait, OTUs. Just for the listener, what exactly is an OTU in this context?
Good question. In microbial terms, you can think of an OTU as a proxy for a distinct species.
Mm-hmm.
By using environmental DNA, they capture this incredibly wide net of both known cultured organisms and the mysterious uncultured majority that we've never actually seen under a microscope.
So they have this massive web of genetic relationships between roughly 76,000 modern descendants.
Yep. A huge family tree.
But a family tree just tells you who is related to who, right? It doesn't automatically print a time stamp on those branch points. How do they anchor that genetic data to actual time in the Mesoproterozoic era?
Well, they use 77 well-supported fossil calibrations. While the fossil record is sparse, we do have a few highly reliable anchor points. For instance, there is a very famous widely accepted fossil called Bangiomorpha.
Bangiomorpha.
Right, which is an ancient red algae dating back to about 150 million years ago. So the researchers tell their computer models, whatever branch of this genetic tree represents red algae, lock that branch at exactly 150 million years.
Got it.
By feeding the model 77 of these specific physical anchors, they calibrate what is known as a molecular clock.
Oh, I see. So the model calculates a steady rate at which that ribosomal DNA mutates and then uses those 77 fossil anchors to mathematically trace the genetic branches backward deep into the past.
Exactly. Well, I shouldn't say exactly. Let me explain the final step because it's where the real magic happens.
Okay, hit me.
Once they had this massive time-calibrated tree, they ran it through advanced birth-death diversification models. Specifically, they used one called CLADLIS to estimate diversity through time.
Birth-death models. I assume that means calculating speciation when new species are born and extinction when they die out.
You've got the concept perfectly. Think of a family tree. It doesn't just grow outward continuously.
Right.
Branches get pruned by extinction all the time.
Sure.
If you only look at the organisms that survive to the present day, you are missing all the dead branches, which completely skews your understanding of how diverse an ecosystem used to be.
That makes sense.
So a birth-death model like CLADS analyzes the shape and the splitting rates of the modern branches to mathematically infer how many unseen extinct branches must have existed in the past to result in the tree we see today.
So instead of trying to reconstruct an ancient dead language from a few weathered stones, they basically analyzed the genetic slang used by 75,000 modern descendants to trace the language back to its origin.
What's fascinating here is that that is a phenomenal analogy.
Yes.
They use the living genetic slang of today's microbial oceans to reveal the hidden ghosts of the phylogenetic tree.
That is just wild.
Right. The models allowed them to look right past the missing fossils and reconstruct the actual living breeding dynamics of those ancient ecosystems.
And the picture those models painted, I mean, it completely shatters the myth of the boring billion. It wasn't a biological pause button at all, was it?
Not even close. The data tells a completely different story. When the massive computational dust settled, the molecular clock placed LEC, the last eukaryotic common ancestor, at approximately 1775 million years ago.
Wow, okay.
And that lines up beautifully with those earliest ambiguous acritarch fossils we talked about. But the real revelation is what happened next. Rather than stagnating for 600 million years, eukaryotes entered a phase of steady, relentless diversification throughout the entire Proterozoic era.
So if it wasn't a biological pause, who was actually winning this invisible evolutionary race?
Well, the breakout star of this ancient steady expansion was a supergroup known as Archaeplastida.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Archaeplastida, who are they?
This is the lineage that includes the direct ancestors of modern red and green algae, and eventually all the land plants you see outside today. The genetic models showed that Archaeplastida experienced the absolute fastest early accumulation of lineages of any eukaryotic group. They basically burst onto the scene around 1,343 million years ago.
So they were completely dominating the microscopic world and remained the most diverse group for hundreds of millions of years. But they couldn't have been alone, right?
They definitely weren't. Closely tracking the success of the Archaeplastida were several supergroups of heterotrophs.
Heterotrophs being organisms that survive by consuming other organisms rather than making their own food, right?
Exactly, the eaters. The models revealed that groups like Discoba, Amoebozoa, and Rhizaria closely followed the photosynthesizers, showing strong, highly diverse phylogenetic roots deep in the same era.
But wait, if they were all thriving and multiplying so successfully 1.3 billion years ago, where were they hiding? Why didn't they leave a more obvious mark on the global geology of the planet?
That's a billion-dollar question.
I mean, if they were everywhere, surely the Spillrongs effect wouldn't hide all of them, right?
Well, the key word there is everywhere. The researchers hypothesized that they weren't everywhere at all.
Oh, they weren't.
No. These early eukaryotes were likely confined to very specific, highly stable environments. Think about shallow, sunlit, newly oxygenated coastal areas.
Why just the coasts?
Because the open ocean back then was a brutal place. It was largely devoid of oxygen and filled with toxic chemicals like hydrogen sulfide. Complex eukaryotic cells desperately need oxygen to function efficiently.
So these coastal margins were like protected biological incubators.
They were safe havens, yeah. The eukaryotes thrive there, building incredibly complex, localized communities for hundreds of millions of years before the rest of the planet's oceans became oxygenated enough for them to take over the globe.
And we have to dig into why the Archaeoplastida supergroup became the undisputed kings of those coastal incubators. Because it wasn't just random luck, was it? They pulled off one of the greatest cellular heists in the history of biology.
Oh, absolutely. You're talking about endosymbiosis. It is arguably the single most important evolutionary leap in the history of life, aside from the origin of life itself. And the mechanics of it are almost unbelievable.
Let's set the scene for us.
So, an early predatory ancestor of the Archaeoplastida encountered a cyanobacterium, which is a tiny, free-living bacteria that had already evolved the ability to perform photosynthesis.
So the predator swallows the bacteria. Normally, that's just lunch.
Normally, yes.
Yeah.
The host cell would flood the compartment with digestive enzymes and break the bacteria down for nutrients.
But this time it didn't.
For whatever reason, perhaps a mutation in the host's digestive machinery or a defense mechanism from the bacteria, the cyanobacterium survived inside the host cell.
Just living inside it.
Yep. And it kept doing what it did best, turning sunlight and carbon dioxide into sugar. The host cell suddenly found itself with an internal, endlessly renewable food source. It was leaking excess sugar right into the host's cytoplasm.
That is wild.
It really is. Over countless generations, the relationship became permanent. The engulfed bacteria actually transferred most of its own DNA into the host cell's nucleus, completely surrendering its independence to become a specialized organelle. It became the first plastid.
So Archaeoplastida basically invented the ultimate biological solar panel, which gave them an incredible energy monopoly.
They didn't have to hunt anymore. They just needed to float in the sunshine.
But did that make them an all-you-can-eat buffet for everyone else? Because if you're a microscopic blob packed full of delicious sun-generated sugar, you're a pretty big target in that coastal incubator.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the data strongly suggests that is exactly what happened. The invention of that biological solar panel fundamentally changed the global economy of life.
It created a gold rush.
Exactly. Once you have a massive localized population of organisms turning sunlight into stored chemical energy, you've created a wildly lucrative food source. The evolutionary pressure to tap into that food source is immense.
Which explains the rise of those other groups you mentioned, the heterotrophs. The Discoba, the Amoebozoa, the Rhizaria, they evolved to eat the solar panels.
It sparked a vicious, ancient predator-prey arms race. The genetic models show the heterotrophs diversifying in lockstep with the photosynthesizers.
Wow.
And while the early rock record is mostly silent, as we move into the late Proterozoic, we actually start to see the fossilized battle scars of this invisible war. Paleontologists have found organic walled microfossils from this time with tiny, perfectly ovoid perforations punched completely through them.
Like microscopic bite marks from a predator drilling into a shell?
Exactly like that. It is direct, physical evidence of selective predation. One cell purposely attacking, drilling into, and consuming another.
That's terrifying, even on a microscopic scale.
Right. And in response to this predation, we see the prey evolve defenses. Around 810 million years ago, fossils appear with biomineralized scales, basically early armor plating.
They built armor?
They did. And by about 740 million years ago, we see the appearance of testate amoebae. These are predatory amoebas that built their own tiny protective shells to live inside while they hunted, almost like microscopic tanks.
It's astounding. The Boring Billion was actually a billion years of intense, covert military research and development by early single-celled life.
It was anything but boring.
Right. The genetic models predicted the arms race, and the late arriving fossils confirm it. But let's talk about the boundaries of this study. As massive as this genetic dragnet was, the authors acknowledge they didn't map every single microbe on Earth, did they?
No, they didn't. The researchers are highly transparent about the limitations of their dataset. Even though they analyzed nearly 76,000 distinct OTUs, the birth-death diversification models suggest a pretty massive gap.
How massive?
Well, models indicate that this staggering amount of genetic data only captures between 50% and 77% of the total eukaryotic diversity actually present on the planet today.
Wait, really? So even with modern sequencing technology, massive global databases, and supercomputers, we are still completely blind to anywhere from a quarter to half of the complex microbial life on Earth.
We really are. There is a vast ocean of hidden diversity still out there. Much of it is likely locked away in extreme or hard-to-reach environments that we just haven't comprehensively sampled yet.
Like where?
Places like the deep ocean trenches or complex, oxygen-deprived sediment layers. Because the genetic slang of those hidden communities wasn't fully represented in this study, our picture of early eukaryotic evolution is still only partially complete.
So there could be entire deep branching lineages of the eukaryotic family tree hiding in a deep sea vent right now, just waiting to be sequenced.
It is highly probable. But importantly, the models they used, like clades, are specifically designed to mathematically account for missing data and incomplete sampling.
Okay, so the math holds up.
Exactly. So while the exact number of branches might shift slightly as we discover more microbes, the overall trajectory holds true. The fundamental finding that early eukaryotes experienced a slow, steady, relentless diversification starting in the mid-Proterozoic is incredibly robust.
So what does this all mean? If we step back from the massive data sets, the 76,000 genetic barcodes, the birth-death models, and the microscopic bite marks, what is the ultimate takeaway for the listener from this deep dive?
The Mesoproterozoic was not a period of evolutionary stasis, but a highly active era where early eukaryotes steadily diversified. Driven by the superpower of photosynthesis and the ensuing pressures of predation, complex cellular life was already building dynamic ecosystems long before they left an undeniable mark in the fossil record. What does this mean for our understanding of how complex life might be silently living in the hidden oceans of other planets right now?
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.
Midnight in the lab, bright screens like tides, long red letters drift where the old world hides. In dust and echoes, a living outline grows, not one sudden spark, just how the river flows. We trace the branches back through shadowed years, past broken fossils, past the quiet fears. A clock that hums where memory is thin, says life kept learning how to begin. Steady light, deep time, let it rise from the mid-Proterozoic to our own. In the dark, turning dawn to skin. Archiplasted, holding early ground, while predators and partners.